You guys know I'm crazy about Audible because it offers an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. Audible really is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment, with female writers and heroines, celebrity narration, multicast productions with immersive sound design, and traditional audiobooks. Audible has you covered for any type of excitement that you're looking for. In fact, right now I'm listening to The Second Husband by Kate White. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. That's audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. With four daughters and two on a dance team, I can tell you we go through a lot of mascara in my house. But I'm crazy about L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, which catches every lash from corner to corner for maximum volume. If you're looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank, this is yours. The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. I've been using it for about 2 weeks now, and I feel like my eye has completely opened up, and the girls are crazy about it too. They've got a tapered brush to catch every lash, one of the best mascara wands that I've ever used. And like I said, this luxe appearance of this gold package, you got to get it. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today. L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, you're going to love it. Welcome back to another episode of Reality Life with Kate Casey. This week, a new 30 for 30 comes out. 30 for 30 is this incredible sports series through ESPN Films. Every year, they get thousands and thousands of submissions and choose four sports stories to tell, if you can believe it. I've interviewed the creator. It's one of my favorite episodes. This week, they have a new documentary called 144. And it's about the unprecedented 2020 WNBA season in the bubble. First, let me say I'm a sports person. I played collegiate field hockey and lacrosse. I coached before I had kids. My kids play sports. I am such a proponent of women and sports, and I implore everybody else to do the same, just to support teams. And what I love about this documentary is that after COVID-19 shut down sports, many leagues were forced to figure out how to save their seasons. So the WNBA did something incredible. They created this single site at the IMG Academy in Bradenton, Florida, where 144 players across 12 teams played 147 games from July to October of 2020. So this is directed by two women. They spent 62 days in the bubble. And the documentary explores the season dedicated to social justice and all that the players had to overcome to get through it. So the pandemic, the demands of activism, and the rigors of an unrelenting schedule. So I want you to check that out. It's called 144. This episode I'm crazy about. Alex Baskin is president of Evolution Media. They are known for innovative television programming, films, and documentaries, many of which are some of your probably your favorite shows. So Alex discusses with me this season of The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, Vanderpump Rules, which they started filming, The Big Shot with Bethany, which they produced, The Hills, which premieres this week, and Botched, which premieres next week. They make so many shows that you love. I interviewed Alex and his partner, Doug Ross, almost 5 years ago in studio. And we talked about casting for shows like Real Housewives of Orange County. And we remained friends. And I'm always in awe of just how talented he is, how funny he is. And he's just like just a great person to talk to about TV and filmmaking. So I knew that you guys would be most excited too, because The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills premieres this month. And, you know, we've kind of all been watching the story that's unfolding relating to Erica Girardi, which, you know, she's also known as Erica Jane as her stage name. She's got quite a bit of legal stuff going on. And I was eager to know from Alex how much that factors into filming. How open can someone be? Does it affect the way that you're filming? You know, are you mindful that this could become, that the film could be subpoenaed at a later date? So I really wanted to get a behind-the-scenes look at how these producers and directors work, especially with castmates that are going through difficult times. And then I've been watching this series on HBO that's called Pray, Obey, Kill. If you love true crime, this is right up your alley. It's Swedish, so it's a really interesting look at one of their most notorious homicide cases. And it tries to unravel a new perspective on this horrific incident of adultery and deception. And as new revelations related to this infamous case keep cropping up even today, there are two investigative journalists, Anton Berg and Martin Johnson, that are filmed throughout the series that are trying to unravel the case. And it's expertly directed by Henrik Georgsen. So I tracked all three of them this week in Sweden. Okay? Can you believe this? And I had to ask him about this series. And so basically the background is this. This delves into the 2004 murder of Alexandra Fossmo. So her nanny, Sara, confesses to the crime, claiming she'd acted on behalf of anonymous texts that she believed were from God. But the story is far more complicated than that because the texts were eventually traced to the phone of Alexandra's husband, Helga, a local pastor who was having an affair with the nanny, the wife of his neighbor, Daniel, who, by the way, was also shot on the same night as Alexandra, but survived, and also sleeping with Alexandra's sister, Osa. She is considered the bride of Christ within this religious sect in this very small town in Sweden. So Osa is the leader of a Pentecostal sect, and it's in this town called Knutby, Sweden. And like I said, she's believed to be destined to be the bride of Christ. So under her leadership, church members claimed that she propagated an intense culture of abuse and intimidation. And in March 2020, she was convicted on 8 counts of assault against former parishioners. The prosecutor demanded prison time, but instead she was given a suspended sentence with community service for 120 hours. She was never prosecuted in connection to Alexandra's murder. Again, Alexandra was her sister. But Alexandra's husband, Helga, who was having an affair with Osa, claimed that it was her, not him, who was behind the text to Sara, the nanny. And so it's a whole crazy story. But every episode, you're just like, what? So it just has so much there. You've got this tiny town in this remote area of the country. And I was eager to talk to them about the series because as an American, listening to how the case unfolded and how their legal system and their media looked at those that committed the crime are so different than the way we look at as Americans that it was kind of interesting to unpack. And like I said, track them down in Sweden. And the one journalist, I made a joke. I said, you know, you look like you're in a Swedish boy band. And he was like, what are you talking about? And then told me he has 4 kids. So I just really hope that you guys check that out. It's so interesting. So I'm going to tell you, this is a great episode. So like get something to drink, go for a good long walk and share it with your friends because it's going to be one of your favorites. So Alex Baskin, president of Evolution Media, and then the team behind Pray, Obey, Kill on HBO. So here we go. Alex Baskin, president of Evolution Media. He is an absolute superstar in unscripted media. And guess what? He's my friend. Alex, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Kate. Thanks for having me.
How annoying am I in your messages telling you about what shows you should watch? Do you feel like I'm a burden or do you dig it?
No, I actually appreciate it because I like you that you curate everything for me because there's a ton to keep track of. There's a lot of great stuff to watch. And So I find it very helpful, actually.
Oh, good. Okay, well, you have so many projects you're working on, and we're going to go through them. But the first one out of the gate that I've got to ask you about is Big Shot with Bethany. Was this your first time working with Bethany Frankel?
So Bethany had appeared on The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills a couple times.
Oh, that's right.
But yeah. So, and made, I would say, memorable guest turns on the show because it's Bethany. So she doesn't just sort of show up and blend in. So we actually got story out of it, which was great. And I actually think that Erica Jane made her name initially on Beverly Hills by having a little stare down with Bethany. So, which is when we knew that Erica Jane was a force to be reckoned with, right? So she went up against the Queen Bee.
That is true.
Yeah. But this is the first time that we as a company had worked with Bethany on a bigger scale, where she was, you know, centrally in a show.
How does she differ in her personality from other housewives?
Oh my God, she is definitely one of the kind. The thing that I appreciate beyond obviously all of her qualities that are made for TV is she is no bullshit. And so there is no standing on ceremony. And, some of the talent on shows can, at some points, want to keep you on the phone forever because they want the attention and they want the coddling. Bethany does not want to be on the phone with you forever. Bethany wants to let you know what she's thinking, and then she wants you to do what she's thinking.
Got it. And is it a fast moving set because she's so quick?
Very. And actually, that was one of the challenges of shooting this show in these times. So we shot this right in the midst of the pandemic. And it's very hard to have spontaneity right now because can only be out in public so much and you know, in certain ways. And so that part of it was really quick. But part of what Bethany told us when we were tapped to do the show is the challenge for you is going to be keeping up with me. And she did not in any way want to slow down to make concessions for production because her contention was that the show would be better if it reflected the hectic and ever-changing nature of her life. And so it certainly challenged the production team and they pulled it off very capably. And I think the show is the better for it. I don't think it feels like any other show of its ilk. Obviously, people make the comparison to The Apprentice, but the truth is, you know, this is a lot about Bethany's life, and it's about personally what she's looking for and what she needs. And as much as it's a competition series, it plays out in reality. Through kind of the whirlwind of Bethany.
So she's looking for a director of operations. She's got quite a complex business. How difficult was it to film given privacy issues with clients or colleagues and the nature of the complexity of her business?
Very difficult to film because it all kind of goes back to everything being subject to change at a moment's notice. And so Bethany has a lot of deals and she had said, I'm going to open up everything that's happening to you guys, but then some of the stuff might end up changing and I might end up preempting it with another deal that I'm making. And all of that did happen. But to your point, I think, you know, the unsung heroes of any show are the people who work behind the scenes, who do all of the coordinating, not just of the shoots, but also of the people who are involved in the shoots, who have to try to clear access, who will, work tirelessly to set up a shoot that then might be canceled at the last minute and have to pivot to something else. So there was a ton of that. And again, I can't underscore that the time we were shooting this was in New York City, no less, was virtually impossible. I mean, there were not a lot of things shooting in New York at the time, but this was a priority for HBO Max. And Bethany is also not someone who wants to wait until the coast clears. And so we were going to do the show and we were going to do it then. And we did, and we pulled it off. And I think that where it translates creatively is I think you do feel a sense of urgency. And I think you feel this frenetic energy and tension that was also really important to Bethany. And I think you get that in the viewing experience.
How many of the contestants and crew members go to sleep at night with one eye open because of the experience of working with her? Did it forever change them? Did it rattle them? Are they as scared as some of the people that watch her on Real Housewives of New York?
She's very intimidating. And so she does not suffer fools. And to work with her is to expect emails in the middle of the night that are stream of consciousness that she will not forget about in the morning. So I will say that there is a restlessness and that that inhabits her and that she sort of demands that everyone tend to because that's what she would be doing. So she expects of everyone what she expects of herself. And I would say it's a very high standard, but She's also been very gracious in how pleased she was with the outcome of the show, with the final product. And so that's been nice to see, because I will say that if you can meet the Bethany standard, as ever-changing and exacting as it might be, then you've done something right. So really proud of the team that made the show.
Also, some of the people that were let go in the beginning, like Nicole and Ashley, I'm like, this is a director of operations business for Bethany Frankel. Like, you're too green. You don't have thick enough skin. There's no way. So when you were casting for the potential director of operations, did you let these people know, like, this is a for real job? Like, you're going to be sweating bullets every single day that you're working this job?
We did. I mean, it's always kind of the first principle of any casting along these lines is to let the people know who are applying for the job know this is a real job. And we're covering this for a TV show, and we're not going to make any bones about that. But really, the deal is you are going to end up working for Bethany. And that's that. And we weeded out a lot of people who either wanted a TV opportunity or didn't, just wouldn't have made sense. And Bethany had a say in the casting also, because we also didn't want to just, throw a bunch of people to her that she would never end up hiring. That said, she had her concerns throughout, because again, no one is up to Bethany's standard. So pretty much ever. So it was fault for her throughout to wrap her head around at various points hiring anybody, because she was disappointed with a lot, but they learned a lot and they came a long way. And she ended up really hiring someone who is really working for her. And where I would say it all, this series also differs from The Apprentice, is Bethany's business, while big in might, is small and personal. So it's not simply hiring someone on a vanity basis who's not going to have to deal with her. It's someone who is going to have to fit into her small and very taxed team. And so that's the cool thing about it. The stakes are real across the board.
I love that the business managers are a father-son team. I thought that was pretty cool. Her assistant does seem ruthless. I like a ruthless worker personally, but I'm from Philadelphia. And also I was just wondering, as you were filming this, like, what's the one thing that you were surprised to learn about her? Because I feel like after season of Real Housewives that we have sort of this idea of Bethany, but working up close to her, was there something that surprised you about her?
I think that what I really learned is that that's who she is, and that there is no intensifying for TV. And so the Bethany that you see on Housewives and with her group of friends on that show is exactly the Bethany that we would see in meetings with 50 people on Zoom. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's the thing that you can't appreciate until you see it in different contexts, and especially in business settings, where sometimes you'll see the central talent of a show shrink or try to perform. She's not performing. That is who she is. And you can love it or you can leave it, but that's who Bethany is, and that is who she will always be. And so I think that's the thing that's impressive to me, because she is nonstop, always going, and at a level 11. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of what I came to appreciate. And again, I think that the team, by the end of the run with her, had gotten more used to it, but I think it was jarring at first.
To say the least.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we've got to talk about Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. I had the treat of watching the premiere last night in total silence with a glass of wine. It was really the most delightful hour. And I have to say, it was really good. I am really most excited personally with the addition of Kathy Hilton, because I think that the nuances of a relationship between sisters, particularly the Hilton sisters, is something that I've been waiting for you to explore. How hard has it been to convince Kathy Hilton to join the show? How were you able to do it?
Well, I've been chasing Kathy for a while now. And I adore Kathy, and I am endlessly amused by her, and she can't help but make good TV, and she's someone that you want to get to know more. And I think that the audience is just going to love her, because she's also, in addition to being Kyle's sister and bringing the lifestyle and all of that stuff, and being the real deal, you know, in terms of social status, she's really eccentric and funny. And so I think that that is, that adds a lot to the group. But I think the reason that she decided to do the show this season is she couldn't travel. She's usually a jet setter, and she's got a bunch of places to go. And so I think that it worked to our advantage that if she wanted an adventure, it was going to have to be one close to home. So I think it's no more complicated than that. I had a dinner with her where I was, I could tell that she was more open to doing the show this season than she had been. And I thought, I'm really going to go for it. And lo and behold, she ended up agreeing to do it. And we are so much the better for it.
Absolutely. And do we get to see her kids, her husband, her whole life?
You don't, you really see her, because as a friend, she's in a lot of the show and she's with the women a lot, but she's not as much the you know, her life isn't as much the focus. I think you get to know her and you'll know much more what she's about. But it's really a lot of her with the other women. She does have a very memorable dinner party, which
I've heard about it.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. And it's, you know, three butlers with white gloves who cannot believe the brouhaha. And that is Erica V. Sutton. And so, you know, that is a great moment this season. And it's just so quintessentially what's great about this show when it's kind of firing on all cylinders. So I think that I think everybody will really get to know and love Kathy in season 11.
You know what happened? I was in a clubhouse with Nikki and Paris, and they mentioned that dinner scene. And they said their brother called them and said, I don't know what's going on downstairs, but it's crazy. So that's so funny. But do you think you could convince her after this that maybe she could be full time? Like, did you massage her shoulders enough? Like, this is going to be fun and cool. Or maybe we won't know until the show airs and people will be so enamored by her that she'll see that it's kind of like a great thing.
I think we're going to have to see. I think that I think she had a lot of fun doing it, which is great. And I said it was a wild ride for her in a good way.
Okay.
We'll see sort of where the show, where it heads. I just know that her presence is really great and really fun on it. And the women love hanging out with her and are just endlessly amused by her.
What about Kyle? Was she sort of like a Teresa Melissa situation where it was like, this is my show, beat it? Or was she sort of at ease because she had her sister? And also, was Kim pissed that Kathy joined?
Kathy's sisters were both really supportive of it. So Kyle had actually suggested it as well and just thought that it would be really fun. And thought Kathy would be great on the show. And Kim, same thing. I mean, I know Kathy had spoken to Kim before deciding that she was going to sign on. And I know Kim was, you know, nothing but encouraging of it. And so I think their thinking was that Kathy didn't really fully appreciate what she was getting herself into, because I think that it's one thing to watch the show and even to see, you know, what her sister's experience was on the show. And it's quite another thing to be in the middle of it. But I think they both thought that that she would be great, and that if she wanted to do it, then, she had their full support.
Okay, let's talk Erica Jayne. When did you start filming the show?
We started filming the show in October.
So she announces she's leaving Tom on Election Day, which was, by the way, a brilliant day to announce a divorce, I have to say. What are we going to expect this season? Because she has been such a private person, and it was shocking to hear that she even filed for divorce. And of course, we've seen all the story sort of unfolding. How much are we going to see in the show? And what was that like filming that during, you know, during that period of time?
You're going to see a lot. You're going to see Erica's personal story play out pretty much in full.
Wow.
So she, for someone who is private, she really went there in terms of telling her story and what she went through across the board, what her marriage was like, and then kind of where she is now. So obviously there are legal considerations.
Right.
But she otherwise was, she's open. And the other thing is, so were the other women. And so, you know, I think that there has in some quarters been criticism of the show for not always going there. That's been the perception, you know, of right. it anyway. And, you know, I think that I don't think it's completely fair in a lot of cases, because I think that there are lots of sort of non-stories that I think on Twitter play as huge stories, but that maybe don't, you know, really impact someone's life in the way that Twitter might think.
Like, give me an example.
Well, I think there are, I don't have one specific example in mind, but I will say that every time there is any lawsuit, then Twitter explodes and,
right.
and we'll call the person in the lawsuit a con and a fraud. Clearly this is a different situation. So, right. So clearly this is real. This is big. This is life, you know, this is, life shattering. This is not just a scandal because the audience is looking for one. It's a real big, very serious situation. And it's treated as such. And so there are lots of different opinions within the group. And those are expressed to Erica. Those are expressed about Erica. Erica's aware of that. It changes relationships. And so that's the thing that's interesting to me, is we also don't get stuck on any one thing. There is no, gate this season where we, the story constantly moves. And there are a ton of developments. There's a ton of developments in Erica's life, but then also within the group as it relates to Erica's life and their thoughts on things. And so truly, it's fast moving. And, you know, again, relationships aren't static. And that's when I think the show is really at its best. But, you know, there's no holding back. It's all covered.
Do you worry at all as a filmmaker, as a television producer, that if you have somebody who's in a legal predicament like that, that some of your footage may be subpoenaed? I mean, doesn't that complicate filming? Does that make you at all feel worrisome about keeping someone on a show because the complication from it? How does that work out from behind the scenes?
Well, we really can only focus on making the show and covering the developing story between the cast. So that's something that obviously someone involved in a legal matter is going to have to concern themselves with. But really, we always tell our team, just make the show, you know, and then if those complications happen for us, then we'll deal with them. But otherwise, you don't want either the people involved in the show or your team to play legal expert and to extrapolate out what, you know, they might need to be concerned about. And so I think the rest of that just sort of all ends up taking care of itself.
So we will see the reaction of the castmates. You've mentioned that you'll kind of see the splintering of some relationships in Erica's world. We also see Garcelle and Sutton have this friendship that seems to be stronger than other friendships. Sutton was just a friend last year, and I know that there were issues because of her ex-husband not wanting her to film that much with the kids, but this year she's a full cast member, correct?
So she is.
Will we see more of her personal life as well?
You will. You'll see Sutton's life in full. And she has a really strong second season on the whole. So she just, I'm proud of her because she just really lets go this season and is, I think, a ton of fun. What I love about Sutton is she is unlike anyone else we've ever seen on that show. She just has a different, you know, prism through which she views the world. And I think that she is she's a ton of fun. And you'll see early on, there are some fireworks between her and the new housewife, Crystal.
Yeah.
And so that's, which is really fun to see, which I know was, previewed a little bit in the super tease that we put out. And I have to give Crystal a shout out because I think coming into this group and immediately getting into it is difficult for a lot of people. And this was not put on. She was not in any way trying to earn her stripes, but she was just very strong. And so I was impressed by that. And so I think the audience is going to like Crystal out of the gate too.
Now, there was a teaser for the second episode, and it's a conversation between Garcelle and Kyle about race. So which I'm excited to see play out because Garcelle is a tremendous cast member. And she spoke to me last season about the pressures of being a Black housewife on a predominantly white cast. And now you've hired an Asian cast member. How much will we hear about race issues throughout the season?
Well, they come up where they really came up. So it wasn't on our part a concerted effort by any means to make that a topic of conversation, but that naturally comes up and in spots. So I wouldn't say that it's a theme or focus of the season, but it also isn't something that we shy away from either. And so it comes up, especially early on a couple times, just naturally in interactions. And I think that they're pretty good quality exchanges. And I think that it's tackled as a real subject, not exploited. And but I also think that, listen, I think it's hard. I think that on a show like Housewives, I think that you want the audience to be able to enjoy the show. See the obviously part of that is seeing when the cast gets into it, when they have very strong feelings about things. But you also don't want it to be uncomfortable either. So it's a very tough balance of what is real, what's important, you know, to the group of friends. And I think that all of that comes across. That is as you know, Crystal says early on the season, this is part of who I am, you know, but I am Asian. And so it's that comes up and like a lot of things as you're sort of getting to know her and kicks things off.
She's so perfect. I mean, I've been saying to you forever, like, oh, I just wish we could see like somebody who's the wife of like a studio head or a director.
Yeah.
And the fact that she's also this beautiful Asian woman. I mean, how did you find her? And are you just so elated with the choice? Because she seems so perfect.
We were really excited when she came into our world. She knows a lot of people that are linked to us. So there were some pretty direct connections. And then we saw her in her interview and loved her right away.
Yeah.
And so she has, you know, to your point, she is obvious in a lot of ways because she's beautiful and she is married to someone who's prominent in Hollywood. But then in the end, if someone isn't all that appealing or if they don't have whatever that spark is, none of that matters.
Yeah.
But what we loved about her is she's also someone who is on the younger side, but all of the socialites in town know her and she has them eating out of her hand. And I love that. So she's someone who you would just, you know, hear about around town anyway, which is just so awesome.
So perfect. Okay. So I can't tell you how I'm so freaking excited for this season. And then Pump Rules is coming back. You start filming next week, I think, right?
Yeah.
And what do we have to look forward to? I mean, obviously Lala and Sheena have had a baby. Did you worry at all about how the element of a new baby might shift the kind of the theme of the show? Because it's for so long been about people behaving badly, right? going to Vegas, not remembering anything, and now you have someone breastfeeding. Like, how does that shape the future of the show?
Well, I think a couple of things. I think that this group has been around for a little while now. So I think life does go on. I mean, you know, you've seen a bunch of weddings on the show. And so I think that you can't, you know, there's nothing that you can do to stop progress. But I will say this, this is also not a group that has matured in the conventional way. And so I don't worry that that they are, you know, just going to settle down into, you know, a perfect suburban fairy tale. I think that it'll be interesting to see how they navigate, you know, a bunch of things that might sort of represent life milestones for other people, but to them, you know, are fit into the way that they like to live and their friend group and all of the things that they do. So I think it's great. We haven't filmed the show in a very long time. So that's the other thing that's interesting to me is, you know, we last filmed in 2019. So obviously a lot has happened both on and off the show, and, and the show made headlines for a lot of reasons, and there's all of that. But if you strip out all of that, I can't tell you how excited everyone is that we have cameras back up again. And all I've been hearing during all of that time, you know, forget the intense speculation and interest in whether the show is coming back, but from the group itself, it would just, you know, virtually every day hear about all the things that we should have been covering, all the developments in life, and now we're covering them again.
And will we see a bunch of new people, because Jax and Brittany are gone, Stassi's gone, who else is gone? Just Kristen's gone, right? So you're going to have to add a bunch of new people, no?
Well, we have a still a very large cast, and so that show has always had a larger cast than pretty much any other. So it's always been a challenge to cover. So we're not looking to replace every single body that is no longer on the show, and so part of it is, you know, we have our eyes on a bunch of people, but we're not trying to cast into that friend group. And we also are looking to see what ends up transpiring, you know, in the businesses, and then we'll be there to cover it. So we have a lot of thoughts, but we're going to see how it all plays out.
And you're just in the beginning of filming anyway.
Exactly.
Is there a chance that Stassi and Kristen or Jax, they, in your kind of inner office discussions, like maybe at some point we might consider just having them drop back in? Or do you just think, you know, we've kind of moved on?
We don't have any plans for that, because we're just focused on what is immediately in front of us.
Right.
So that's what I would say. I mean, genuinely, like I think that, you know, that's one of those answers that I think probably people would think that I'm being, you know, careful. I'm just not. It's just isn't something that we've discussed, because we just have, you know, a big task ahead of us, which is covering the current group and, you know, and in some ways remaking that show on the fly. And it's a really exciting challenge. So it's daunting, but we're up for it.
Okay. So in addition to this, you've got Botched coming back on May 18th. You've got The Hills back on May 12th. What can we expect about The Hills?
Well, you can expect to see a group that has shifting relationships. You can expect to see some unexpected romances. You can expect to see a lot happen from a group that has known each other for a long time. And I think, like the Vanderpump Rules cast, has a remarkable capacity to get into it with each other and then bounce back. And that's always the magic of real life relationships with a deep history. Those are the things that you can't cast. And so super excited about that. Botched is really fun season, and the doctors keep outdoing themselves. And I always say this because it's true. They're taking on cases that they never would have taken on in earlier seasons, because they started off the show as experts in revision surgery, but now they are the go-tos across the world. And so they surprise even themselves with what they're doing. So so that's awesome. And I think everybody will enjoy seeing that show. And then there's a bunch more that I am so excited to be able to talk about soon.
Yeah.
There's sort of the next the next crop, which So but hopefully everybody enjoys all of those premieres. A lot of really hard work went into them from great teams who were, again, working under the most difficult conditions. And it's so hard to oversee a production in the first place, but in the time of COVID, and where you're really challenged to keep up with story that's developing in the real world, and you want shows to still have spontaneity, you want them to feel organic, and everything is to be planned within an inch of its life. I think they did such a good job of rolling with the punches, and as a company, we are so proud of the productions and of the shows, and I hope everybody likes them.
Well, and I have to say, I can't say enough about how much respect I have for your crews to do this during the pandemic when we so badly need entertainment. And it's such a nice escape for people in the most trying of times. So that's not forgotten, that you have an extraordinary staff of people that are working in front of the camera, behind the camera. And so I appreciate it. Last question for you is the Mauricio PK show about real estate in London. Are you a part of that?
Not a part of that. So, that was something that the PK put together, and so I wish him I've talked about it a bunch, but I wish them the best of luck with that.
Yeah, that sounds like a great show. Well, listen, thank you a million times. I will let you go back to work, but thank you for all the entertainment, the hard work, and for not blocking me from sending you show suggestions.
No, keep sending them. I really do appreciate it.
Love you, Alex. Thank you.
Thank you.
HBO's Pray, Obey, Kill is a 5-part crime documentary series that takes a look at one of the most notorious homicide cases in Sweden. It tries to unravel a new perspective on what is a horrific accident of adultery and deception. And as new revelations related to this infamous case keep cropping up even today, investigative journalists Anton Berg and Martin Johnson take us through this bizarre true story in the docuseries. My guests today are the director, Henrik Georgeson, and the journalists. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is spellbinding. This series, I have to ask you how long this took, and I need to know if you were able to kind of put this to bed at night ever. Did this consume your lives?
It consumed our lives for 2.5 years.
Did it? 2 years. Oh my God.
2.5 years, actually.
Wow. Tell me what it was about this case that piqued your interest.
I mean, it's one of the most famous cases in Sweden, and because it had so much media attention going back. But me and Anton, we've been working for a long time as investigative journalists, and we'd known in reports in other media that there was parts missing in the technical evidence, or the technical evidence didn't match up with what the main witness was saying. So there was a discrepancy in what the evidence showed and what the most reliable witness had said occurred, and that we found very interesting. But also the fact that the congregation or the cult or the sect actually dissolved around the time when we started working on the case. So suddenly they were speaking openly that they were part of a cult. And so we were very interested in going back in time, trying to understand how can you look at this when everybody is finally speaking the truth of what kind of world they were living in.
It's an interesting sect. It's a Pentecostal sect in a very remote area of Sweden. And what also is extraordinary, and I feel like I've covered a ton of cults, is that at the helm is a woman. How unusual was this group of congregants and their belief system?
In Sweden, that was maybe one of the main reasons that this case was so big, because we have had not so many murders as you over there, but we have murders every year, several. But this was in the very, in this, you know, kind of sect or cult that, that made it very interesting, and it's a very peculiar case in Sweden. So that was the first thing that this was not an ordinary homicide case, right? So, and then all the stuff, you know, the juicy stuff, as we say, all the rumors about sex and things like that made it even bigger, of course.
How did this sect begin?
The congregation is, what is that, 80 years old or something like that. So it's been a normal small congregation for many years, and then kind of started, it seems like, when they brought Åsa Waldau there, the Bride of Christ, and she wanted to, well, get things going a little bit more. So, and she went around in Sweden and preached, and she, you know, she made people come to Knutby, to move to Knutby, young people. And so it grew bigger, the congregation, and for several years. And Helge Fosmo, for instance, the instigator, he came there, and Sara Svensson came there, and a lot of other people. So they moved from other parts of Sweden to this little town. And then it, you know, eventually turned more and more into a sect.
And Åsa only had 1 month of training in order to be a leader of a faith?
In Sweden, you don't have to have any training at all to call yourself pastor, for instance.
Wow.
So,
we're not in the state church, but in these Pentecostal churches, that is.
So whether she had training or not, or how much training they had, that was not actually an issue. She claimed that she heard the voice of God stronger than the others. So, and yeah, okay, people believe that.
And her,
that was maybe one of the first sign of, okay, this is not going well.
And then Helga is an interesting person too. He was the only member, one of five kids, but the only member of his family that he found his calling at, what, age 12? He was the most religious of his family. He moves to this town and sort of starts to work his way up. And he's seen as this moral authority, but he's having affairs and pulls it off without anybody else seemingly knowing.
Yeah, that's correct. And I think it connects with the thought that some people hear the voice of God stronger than others. So you were not to question the authorities in Knutby. If Helge says, "Oh, that's none of your business," okay, well. That's why the title is, you have the obey in the title. That's how central that was.
And in within the congregation, what's the power dynamic between Åsa and Helga? Because they're maintaining an affair, but front facing to the congregation, she has way more power than he does, or what was the dynamic?
I would say that it's Åsa and Helge that together created the idea of the Bride of Christ. So Åsa really needed Helge because he had a lot of because he knew the Bible inside out. So every time they started talking about something, he could find references in the Bible. So in the beginning, they needed each other quite a lot, but then after a while, I think that Åsa maintained the position of being Bride of Christ. But then when more and more of Helge's behavior and Helge's affairs came up, the lesser power, with the less grip he had over the congregation.
So tell us a little bit about the timeline. Helga's married to another woman, Helene, and there is a death. 4 years before the 2004 death. So what happens with Helene?
That's correct. Yeah, Helge is married to a woman called Helene when they moved to Knutby. And she is found dead just before just before Christmas in 1999. And she, I mean, the police never really investigate the case as a potential crime. So they just see it as an accident. But a few, and I think they just went on vacation over Christmas, more or less. But and then a few weeks afterwards, they found out that she had very high doses of morphine in her body. But there was no crime scene and they hadn't collected any evidence. So they more or less shut the case down. So when the police technicians came to the crime scene again in 2004, they recognized the house because they'd been there a few years before and said, oh, this is the second wife that died in the same house. Yeah, to this reverend.
And then he moves in with another woman quickly. He gets rid of all of Helene's belongings. No one seems to think this is weird. And then he begins a relationship with Alexandra, who's Osa's sister, correct?
That's correct.
And then Sara comes into the picture. She becomes the nanny. And at some point, she begins to get these messages. And she goes to Alexandra's house with a hammer and tries to beat her up with the hammer. But Alexandra awakens, fights her off, but doesn't file a police report. I can't get past, how do you wake up with someone trying to beat you with a hammer and not have brain damage?
It wasn't a very strong hit. I think Sara explains that with that she thought she just had to, you know, put the hammer to the head and God would do the rest.
Oh my gosh. This case is just so remarkable. And you see the grooming that Helga does for all of these women who are in a almost like a perpetual state of adolescence where they are so apt to believe that messages are coming from God. You've mentioned before that there's this dynamic that you must obey. You must obey the leader. Helga has a way of just being matter of fact about things, his communication style. So they're just taking him at his word. He's grooming these women to believe that they have to be highly sexual with him to keep these relationships secretive. And as that's going on, what is Osa's role in all of this? What is she telling him? Is she orchestrating this? Or is there also a level where she's being groomed too?
That's a good question. It's definitely one of those questions we try to investigate.
And Alexandra, her relationship with her older sister, what was that like?
It's also quite unclear, isn't it? She was much younger. She was 15 years younger or something like that? There are things that are unclear about their relation, I would say.
Mm. How much was the crime scene in this case with Alexandra and with Daniel compromised? How difficult was it to go through the forensic evidence? Because you're in a very small town. It's in a remote area. And you know, Sara, she puts on shoes that are a size too big. There was speculation, and you guys brilliantly cover that, about whether or not somebody had driven her. How difficult was it to piece together the crime scene when it's done in retrospect and it involves a secretive society and in a remote area of the country?
In Sweden, you can get access to a police investigation that is closed down because it's public domain. So you can ask for parts of the investigation that is open for everyone to see. And so what you're pointing at, that it was a closed society or a closed group, that's one of the things that, you know, was really interesting for us, because the police decided quite early that they wouldn't look at this as a cult or a murder in a cult. They just looked at it as a normal murder in a very special circumstances. So that's why it was very interesting for us to go back into the case again and, you know, look at how the interrogations were done and how what people were lying about and so on. But the most difficult thing for us was when we realized that they've done a reconstruction, and the reconstruction that was shown in court was much, much shorter, or cut down from hours to around 29 minutes. When we tried to get access to that files through demanding it as public domain, you know, we got a hard stop saying it's never been shown to the public before, and it contains sensitive images of Sara, so-called nanny. And then we actually had to have her power of attorney to get that material. And that was the greatest surprise, actually, for me and Anton during this entire thing, that she'd never spoken to media or anything. And suddenly she gained us access to this material.
That was the part where, when all of a sudden you show a clip and, you know, in the upcoming episode, you interview Sara. I just was like, I cannot believe that they got a chance to talk to her. And I wondered, as journalists and as the director, how difficult it was to interview her, because you want to get this, have the story told, but you're probably also mindful that she's a victim. So you don't want to re-victimize somebody, but you also want to get the answers that everybody really has been seeking. So what was your experience working with her in terms of interviewing her all these years later?
It's interesting that you chose the word victim, because a lot of people do when it comes to Sara. But she is not seen in our system. I mean, in our legal system, she's not seen as a victim. She's the perpetrator. She shot two people. And still, I can understand why you choose the word victim. And that made it also, as you point out, hard for us, because we really want to, you know, be straightforward with her. You know, just, we want our answers to the questions, but at the same time, we know we can't, you know, just push too hard.
Yeah.
Because she had a difficult time back then, and she still do. She still have. So yeah, it was of course a process when we have to have these conversations. First, you know, by other people, then directly to her over the phone, and then maybe meet her, and then maybe eventually we got to put her on front of a camera. So it took almost 2 years to get there.
Oh, wow.
The interview is actually made in January this year. So it's extremely... Poor Henrik had been editing the series for a year when this showed up.
And the editing was completed, really, when we got that interview with her. So it was very...
When you find out you can interview her, do you just like punch a wall? Are you like, you know, doing a drop to your knee? Like, that is such a win in terms of filmmaking. Am I right?
Yeah, of course. It was very important to get that interview, of course. Absolutely.
It's interesting how you said in your system that she's seen as the perpetrator. Because as an American, I think if this case were done in the United States, she would be in prison probably for the rest of her life. But your system is a little bit more, looks at it a different way, that she needed psychiatric help. And in America, it's just like you're put into prison and the psychiatric help that may or may not even happen. But yet Americans are very much more, it seems much more understanding of the grooming process. It's something that we talk about regularly in docuseries and true crime, about the grooming of the victim. So it's almost like things are in reverse. We're understanding of the victimization, but that we're going to penalize them and to the nth degree. Whereas you're the opposite, where you're like, you're the perpetrator, but we also get you psychiatric help. Did you find that an interesting dynamic in the way, now that you have put this out into the world and you see how different countries are viewing this and through the lens that they are watching this case?
Yeah, it's very interesting to look at it in an international way, as you point out, because if you look at the two perpetrators here, Helge and Sara, and you look at how they, what have these 17 years done with them, and how they look at what happened. That's very interesting also. I won't give you the answers, but I hope people could have that question, bear that question in mind when they're watching the series, because it's very interesting how different they look at what happened and what their responsibility was. And there are people in Sweden also that think, that still thinks that Sara got too easy, you know, it was too easy on her.
Mm-hmm.
But
that always depends if you get psychiatric care instead of prison as a sentence. I mean, you could stay there for life, actually, in psychiatric care. So it's really the doctors who decide if you will be released or not.
And yeah.
So it's, you know, it could be a worse punishment in a way.
Actually, that's also a thing that's in reverse, because that's the only way you could be in jail for the rest of your life in Sweden, because we don't have that lifetime sentence. Yeah, you could actually. I'm sorry, I was wrong there.
Also, their faith, it's misogynistic in many ways. And his I've listened to some of the transcripts of his preaching, and there are misogynistic undertones where it's like there's a master of heaven and there's a master of, you know, of the church. And in some cases, I think the Swedish term is similar, right? The master term. Anyway, he it's like, you listen to me, women are subservient. So I'm wondering how Swedish press and the people of Sweden look at this case and how they view Åsa, because she is clearly heavily involved in some degree. But the system of their faith is front-facing misogynistic. I don't know what it's like, you know, behind the doors, and we're trying to figure that out as we go through the series. But how does your country and your legal system and your press look at the role of Åsa in this case?
I think that you're pointing to the why the media is so interested in it, because it's a world that they lived in where they look at the Old Testament instead of the New Testament. Mm. The New Testament is filled with love, you could say, and the Old Testament is filled with punishment. And they believe that everything in the Bible is true. So you could live after the Old Testament and live a truthful life, which basically means that the woman should take care of the husband. He should, you know, if he wants to have sex, then she should oblige. I mean, there are ceremonies which we listen to that they talk about that it's okay to beat children. You know, it's quite brutal. And at the same time, they built this world, or this together they've created this throne where they put Åsa, and they're waiting for her to meet Jesus. And in that world that they created, when Åsa's going to meet Jesus, they created this secret that they were all part of. And they were all waiting for Åsa to meet Jesus somehow. So, I mean, they would be part of this. I mean, it would be a reckoning. The new times would be coming, and they would be, you know, they would be the main characters in what was going to happen, because they were around Åsa and they were serving her as a queen. But this, I mean, and another thing that kept the media interest is that people dropped out of this cult after a while, or did regularly, and everybody talked about that Åsa was this, they claimed that she's a queen, but they, you know, always denied it. Said, no, we're a normal congregation. We work with normal values. We believe in God and we believe in love. But every time somebody dropped off, they actually told a completely different story. And when the congregation dissolved, I mean, the defectors had right, but it was, you know, 10 times worse, 15 times worse. People, you know, had lost their health, their money, their children. Was eventually, or the congregation itself had a system where they believed that Åsa was going to meet Jesus when everything was completely right within the congregation. And Jesus never came, so there must have been something wrong. And then people became wrong. So they started beating each other up.
Mm-hmm.
Or they started punishing each other, deciding who should have or allowed to have sexual relationships with their wives and so on. Who's allowed to sleep at home, even. So it became more and more demonic.
It is the most bizarre and fascinating case. And I wondered, my last question is, of all the people that you interviewed, who did you find to be the most surprising interview? For me, I'm just as a viewer, I find Maria, Patrick's wife, to be so interesting. Like, that she was the nanny and she took orders from Osa to be with her husband, and that now she's married to him and raising the children. And I just found it fascinating. So for each one of you, who is the person that you found to be the most surprising interview? Henrik, I'll start with you.
Yeah, the most surprising. Yeah. Actually, Maria is a favorite for me as well. And I mean, the whole story with her husband and Urban, this other pastor, and that whole story is so weird. And it has dimensions, the sex, the idea about why Urban has to have sex with different women for the battle for Åsa coming together with Jesus. That is really hard to understand. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we really managed to tell that story because it was too complicated, really what that was all about. But it was very weird and very interesting as well. But I mean, that's also part of a kind of a power misuse, I guess, with these using, you know, sex as, you know, misusing their power. But yeah, she's my favorite.
Okay, good. Okay, Anton, your turn.
I would say maybe Leif Spornbo, actually, the senior policeman that had done a tremendous job with the interrogations with Helge. And it was very interesting to talk about him, about his strategies and how he looks at the interrogation room. Because in the beginning of the interrogations, he had a sidekick, another officer. And he, sometime in the first five interrogations, he interrupted Leif several times, you know, bursting out against Helge because he didn't stand Helge. So you could see later on, Leif, he was solo. So we asked him about that. And he said, yeah, because I thought it was a good cop, bad cop thing. And Leif, he said, okay, so there is no room for bad cops in the interrogation room. So I had to move him out because we want to have an atmosphere of, no, fear is not good to have in an interrogation room. We have to have a good, you know, talking tone to each other to get somewhere. So that was very interesting. And also that when a policeman says about a murderer that she was a good human being, as he says.
Right, he did.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, that was right. Yeah, you're right. Martin, what about you?
Going through all the interviews that we did, and there's many that even isn't in the series, but I think that one that really, in order to get these interviews, we spent a lot of time building relationships with them. And a man that I still have contact with is the Johan Grimborg, who gives up his children and his wife because Åsa says that that's the correct thing to do. And he's driving there at night and he's, you know, trying to drive as fast so he can kill himself because he can't stand the way that he's living. And that struck, because then a huge note to me, because that made me realize how far you can go when you're as brainwashed. I mean, you can give up your children. You can give up your marriage. You can give up your home. He eventually even slept in a shelter. He didn't even have a home after a while. But he even tried to kill himself, more or less, when he couldn't stand it. But, you know, he never succeeded. And his life story is sort of a symbol for all the mess that it became for everyone, I think.
Well, this is an extraordinary series. You guys did such a fantastic job. Are you going to be able to turn this off your in your head for your new projects, or does this still kind of like stay with you?
Yeah, it's hard actually.
Yeah.
It's like no other story I've ever reported for that very reason that you just said. It's hard to shut it off because it lingers.
Yeah. Well, it's called Pray, Obey, Kill. It's on HBO. It's so good. I commend all of you. Well done. Great work. Thank you for bringing us this extraordinary series.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. I want to thank my fantastic guests, Alex and Anton and Martin and Henrique, and remind you guys to click subscribe and leave a 5-star review. Believe it or not, those 5-star reviews are so, so helpful for podcasters. So if you wouldn't mind doing that for me, and join my Facebook group, Reality Life with Kate Casey, where we're going to talk about this episode and others and what we're watching all week. Of course, I put out a list called What to Watch with Kate every week. And you can find that on all my socials, or you can join my Substack newsletter. And that's at katecasey.substack.com. Free, easy, get it in your mailbox every Monday. And then you have a list of what to watch, and I'm going to save you tons and tons of hours. Also, you can find me on Twitter at Kate Casey. Do you know that Andrew McCarthy from Pretty in Pink tweeted to me today? I lost my mind. I could not even believe it. My Instagram is at Kate Casey CA. On TikTok, I'm at It's Kate Casey. I've got a Patreon page with bonus episodes. You can go to patreon.com/Kate Casey. I have so many great episodes with great co-hosts on my Patreon page. And of course, you can find me on Clubhouse. Every Monday, I give you my what to watch list. And I also admin the Club Bravo group, and I'm always on there eager to hear what other people are watching and what they want to watch. And I'm just grateful that you spent this time with me listening to the episode, and I would love to hear back your feedback. And I'm wishing that you all have a great week. Wait till my episode on Friday. It's so good. You're going to love it.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
Your favorite coffee shop down the street to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.